At few places is the pace of innovation in healthcare matched by that of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I spoke with Dr. Patrick Conway, the Deputy CMS Administrator for Innovation and Quality, and its Chief Medical Officer. He started by reminding us of the size and scope of CMS.
We are the largest payer for healthcare in the U.S.
Probably in the world.
We insure almost 140 million people now. Spend in total almost $1 trillion a year, so over $2.5 billion a day. Certainly, we are shifting how we pay for healthcare and paying for quality instead of volume, which we can talk more about. We also partner with providers in quality improvement. So although we're not direct providers of care, you know, as an example, we're working with 80% of the hospitals in the country on patient safety and improving patient safety in hospitals.
Well, let's start with one of the, I think, most successful efforts that you've had in recent years, and that is the Accountable Care Initiative. The Accountable Care Organizations, I guess, tries to integrate the care from the patient standpoint and improve quality and lower costs. Give us a progress report on that particular innovation.
Yes, so we now have almost 500 accountable care organizations across the U.S. in almost every state, and they are coordinating care for beneficiaries. We've seen quality improve significantly, so improving quality on the vast majority of measures and also improving patient experience, and they're also lowering costs. So we now have cumulatively over $1 billion in savings from the program. I think it's still evolving. I think organizations are still learning how to do this work, and we are learning how to partner best with these accountable care organizations. But, you know, my own mother is in an ACO and receiving coordinated care. She's a Medicare beneficiary, and I think, you know, we're seeing direct impacts on patients and better care coordination for patients.
Can an ACO incorporate organizations that have different corporate entities, that is to say, not a single healthcare system?
They can. Great question. Some ACOs are a single health system, but we have many ACOs, for example, that might be groups of physician practices that decide to work together to coordinate care for beneficiaries, for example, both primary care and specialist physicians agreeing to work together.
Now, sometimes when the quality of healthcare goes up, it's the result of a new treatment or a new measure, say a new cancer drug, which gives a better outcome, but may cost $100,000 a dose or something. So how can explain some ways that quality can improve and costs go down?
Yeah, so what we're seeing, for example, in accountable care organizations or some of our bundled payment models, is that when hospitals and physicians and patients and nursing homes and others work together, they can improve quality of care, but also do things like decrease admissions to the hospital, decrease readmissions to the hospital, you know, decrease length of stay in nursing homes, and really work to get people home and healthy as soon as possible. So that's a good example. With better care coordination, people are able to be discharged from the hospital and stay home and healthy, as opposed to be readmitted to the hospital, or, for example, a primary care doctor preventing an ER visit or an admission to the hospital through better care coordination and engagement with the patient.
So where are you going with the whole accountable care program?
Yeah, it continues to grow substantially. It's, you know, we keep having more provider organizations volunteer physicians and hospitals to move into these new payment models. You know, we're working with the private sector, both payers and providers, really in partnership on this journey. And I think we'll continue to see, you know, we've got ACOs across the entire country, and I think we'll continue to see more and more over time. And I think we've also seen ACOs that have been in the program longer, their results are better. So on average, the longer the ACO is in the program, the better their quality results and the more savings they generate.
We're speaking with Dr. Patrick Conway, Deputy Administrator for Innovation and Quality and the Chief Medical Officer at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And has the Electronic Health Record Initiative in any way helped the enablement, let's say, of accountable care organizations?
It has. I think, you know, by using electronic health records and I'd say technology broadly, including telehealth and other technologies, we're seeing ACOs. For example, we've got ACOs that may monitor patients at home through devices for example, in congestive heart failure, monitoring weight gain, which is a major risk factor that a patient may be readmitted to the hospital. So they're using both electronic health records and remote technology and telehealth to deliver, you know, care when and where the patient needs it. So it's higher quality care at a lower cost.
I mean, from this layperson standpoint, nothing looks stodgier to me than the healthcare profession and the way it's delivered. It sounds like this, besides a different payment model, it sounds like it almost engenders a cultural change on the part of providers to talk to one another so the patient isn't carrying a bundle of records from place to place.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. I'm still a practicing physician on weekends. You know, when I trained, it was handwritten notes, and my handwriting is challenged, like many physicians, and handwritten orders. You know, now when I work in the hospital, you know, I get electronic reports that come in from a patient from an outside area. I can look at x-rays online. I can show them to the patient. You know, when I'm doing discharge summaries, they're electronically transmitted to the primary care provider. I mean, still more work to do on seamless interoperability and really information always flowing with the patient when and how they want. But I think a much better health system today than 5 years ago, and our hope is that it continues to get even better in the future.
Let's talk about episode-based payment initiatives. What is that, and what are you trying to accomplish?
Yeah, so episode-based payment initiatives are when we are saying to a provider that we want high-quality care and care coordination and lower costs for an episode of care. So an example would be a hip and knee replacement, where we have models that are a 90-day episode for a hip and knee replacement. And the incentive is for the provider to generate better health outcomes for the patient, decrease admissions and readmissions, and get the patient home and healthy as soon as possible. And we're seeing great success in terms of improving quality and lowering cost. And that really contrasts, you know, prior to these payment models, if a patient, for example, were to be readmitted to the hospital, we would pay the hospital again. So the incentive was really misaligned with what you'd want, you know, for your own mother or family member, which is well-coordinated care, you know, no infections or complications, and getting home and healthy as quick as possible.
I imagine, unlike hotels, hospitals want to get people in and out as fast as possible. I guess you could call it the turn and earn model.
Yeah, so in the sort of older fee-for-service world, which, you know, certainly still exists as we make this transition, you know, you're paid based on hospitals and physicians are paid based on volume, which, you know, has led to, you know, quick, you know, admission discharge, maybe not with optimal care coordination, you know, in physician offices it can lead to 15-minute office visits that are 15 minutes no matter what. Whereas in our new payment models, for example, in our advanced primary care models, we're seeing primary care practices that set appointments truly based on what the patient needs. So if it's a really complex patient with a lot of needs, it might be an hour appointment because we're paying them differently. So I think the payment model allows providers and doctors to practice the way they want to.
And we've been talking in ways that seem to emphasize care of the elderly. I think people may not necessarily know that CMS also handles the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, You've got some initiatives there too, especially as it relates to the Medicaid population. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. I'm actually a pediatrician by training, so take care of children. You know, we do administer both Medicaid and CHIP. You know, I'd call out a couple examples. We have a state innovation model, which is we're working with 37 states to really transform their health system to achieve, you know, better quality prevention and lower cost at a population level. And many of them are focused on children and better care for children. We also, in the Medicaid and CHIP program, have a number of demonstrations, for example, working on decreasing preterm birth and prematurity and complications from that, and are seeing, as just one example, early elective delivery, which is a major risk factor for preterm birth, is now down 70% in this country over the last several years. So, you know, this focus on children and wellness and prevention and high-quality care for children is a major focus of CMS.
Does that mean there are techniques and strategies now that can delay what would have been premature births earlier?
Yeah, so it's really work. It's a series of interventions to try to decrease preterm birth, and we're seeing, you know, states and communities and nationally us moving in the right direction. So still much more work to do. We still, for example, have disparities in preterm birth in terms of race and ethnic disparities in this country. But, you know, our goal is to both eliminate disparities and to improve overall.
Is it race and ethnic, or is it wealth and poverty?
It's, you know, it's both is the short answer. So certainly higher rates in populations in poverty, lower SES populations, and also higher rates based on race and ethnicity.
People often say it's become a cliche that, you know, 80% of what you're going to spend on healthcare in your life, you spend in the last 2 months before you expire. But I guess it's also fair to say that premature births are extremely expensive.
Exactly. So, you know, obviously, most importantly, a bad outcome for the patient, the child, and the family, but also generate long-term costs. You know, I take care of, you know, many children in the hospital that now are older but are still dealing with complications from preterm birth. And so, like you said, if we can prevent a preterm birth, it most importantly improves quality and outcomes, but also lowers costs in the long term.
I was going to say, yes, not just the taking care of the preemie in the NICU, but also if they have long-term problems, if those are prevented, then there's throughout the life cycle cost.
Exactly.
Now, another area is the initiatives to speed the adoption of best practices, and that sounds like a huge catch-all. Best practices do you mean in particular, or and how do you get the adoption pushed through the system?
Yeah, I'll give two tangible examples. One, in the patient safety arena, we have an initiative called Partnership for Patients, where we're now working with 80% of the hospitals across the country through these hospital engagement networks, which are basically networks to drive adoption of best practices. Over the last 4 years, we've seen an almost 40% reduction in preventable harm. So these are infections, adverse events, other harm. That translates to over 2 million injuries, infections, and adverse events avoided, approximately 87,000 lives saved, and $20 billion in cost savings. And, you know, to make it tangible, you know, I remember taking care of a child who died from a central line infection when I was a resident. You know, we've decreased these bloodstream infections by more than 60% nationally now. So these are real people that, you know, avoid either death or a significant infection and are able to go home and healthy instead, which is why we do this work.
Now, there are lots of federal organizations along with CMS, NIH, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the military medical units, and also VA are also working on some of these hospital prevention deaths initiatives.
Yeah.
How do you work with them and make sure that everybody's not duplicating one another's efforts?
That's a great question. So, you know, we work closely with them. Actually, you know, in patient safety, the Centers for Disease Control actually runs the measurement system along with the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality that we utilize to measure these events. CDC also puts out a lot of the evidence base on prevention of healthcare-acquired infections. And then, you know, the National Institutes of Health, NIH, is really, you know, developing the next generation of evidence, the next new technologies or interventions, along with the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, on what works best in healthcare and how we implement that reliably across our healthcare system.
We're speaking with Dr. Patrick Conway, Deputy Administrator for Innovation and Quality and the Chief Medical Officer at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I imagine there could be innovations from the private sector in terms of drugs, or not so much drugs maybe, but devices and even surgical techniques, for example, that might come into the knowledge of one federal agency, but not to the others. So is there an information transfer type of mechanism?
There is. We actually, great question. We actually set up, we call a learning model, around all these new payment models. So, for example, in our Accountable Care Organization program, we convene them and they learn from each other and we learn from them. So when, you know, one ACO may figure out, you know, I did this intervention to decrease, you know, in my patients that were going to the emergency room many times a year, you know, I did this intervention to coordinate care and it, you know, it worked because of A, B, and C. You know, we share those learnings both across all the various providers, doctors, hospitals in the models, plus we as a federal agency, you know, take those learnings and we'll transmit them across the federal government, including, as you said, we work closely with Veteran Affairs and Department of Defense and others, you know, across the federal government.
Do you ever want to call up the FDA and say, would you hurry up and approve this or that because this is what it's going to save us down the line if we ever get into the marketplace?
Yeah, we work closely with the FDA now. So we work very closely with them on including things like parallel review, where we've now had instances where, you know, a new device is approved by the FDA and literally covered by CMS the same day, which did not ever used to happen. So I think the coordination with the FDA on innovation and new technologies and things that truly improve patient outcomes, having a pathway for those to be approved and covered rapidly is much better than it used to be.
We're speaking with Dr. Patrick Conway, Deputy Administrator for Innovation and Quality, and also the Chief Medical Officer at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And there's something else that has come into the medical field, which is not strictly medicine, and that is big data and the ability to analyze data sets coming in from these billion and trillion dollar programs. How are you using big data and data analysis to figure out where to go next in the innovative models?
Yeah, so big data and data and evaluation really drives all of our work. So to give you some tangible examples, when we launch a new payment model, whether it be ACO or a bundled payment model, you know, we're evaluating data that comes back in we're evaluating that data monthly. We can even do it close to real time. And working with the entities, the provider organizations in the model to determine if adjustments are needed. We also give data to provider organizations to help them drive improvements so that they can really identify care patterns of all the beneficiaries, all the patients that they're serving. So I think rapid cycle data analysis and evaluation is a core principle in all of our work.
And I imagine being a physician, a pediatrician yourself, must be a huge factor in being able to evaluate everything that you're responsible for in the innovative area.
Yes, I truly consider medicine a calling. I love practicing as a physician and serving in that way, and I think it does influence and impact both my policy work and the work in innovation because it gives you a better sense of what it really looks like, you know, on the ground, in a hospital, in a care setting, you know, delivering care to patients.
And as someone who sees young patients, who oversees quality and also oversees programs for innovation, what do you think could best help the health in general, the public health of young people in the United States? Or what things do you think could?
Yeah, you know, I think I mentioned we've made some progress, but I think really focusing on the first 5 years of life, there's good evidence that health trajectories are incredibly important for the long-term quality and cost for both the individual and the health system, and that the first 5 years of life are the sort of real critical period. So I think we are thinking about, should we do even more partnering with states and providers in the pediatric arena, especially looking at this first 5 years of life? How do you not only decrease preterm birth was important, but also, have a health system that supports a child that becomes a healthy, productive adult.
Dr. Patrick Conway is Deputy CMS Administrator for Innovation and Quality and its Chief Medical Officer. Share the entire interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends.